Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am tired from camping in the woods all weekend, but happy to be here with you guys and it being a normal temperature.
I am very happy to be talking about movies with friends. And also, I have literally never once camped.
You're not missing anything. You are not missing anything. All right. As always, thank you to everyone who is listening on Tuesday. It's great hearing from everyone in the comments, particularly in the chat area, the little chat. We got that little mailbox thing. People chime in there, send us. We're actually, the cons and nons today is drawn from the chat. So if you're not in the chat, you're not influencing this show. Also, on the post that Alyssa is doing on the Odyssey, we're right in the thick of it, folks. We are in prime Odyssey territory. So if you're not reading those and commenting and participating in the chat, you're really missing out. Take the leap, become a paying member of Across the Movie Aisle and help keep this thing afloat. We would love to have everyone on board. And now on to controversies and non-controversies. Mr. Beast is maybe in hot water following a sexual harassment lawsuit filed by Lorraine Mavromatis. Apologies, Lorraine, or possibly Lorianne. I don't know. Anyway, following accusations that she was fired from her role after returning from pregnancy leave and being demoted and then otherwise being treated poorly. Just terrible stuff all around. Some of her specific accusations include being told that Mr. Beast himself, Jimmy Donaldson, would not work with her because she is attractive and she, quote, had a certain sexual effect on Jimmy, end quote. And also that she should be happy an advertiser found her sexually attractive. My understanding is you're not allowed to say those things in the modern workplace, is how I understand it. The production company, which employs nearly 500 people, which has the biggest subscriber base on YouTube by far, just an enormous number of subscribers, and has a huge deal with Amazon, where the shows that he is making there are basically total flops, according to the entertainment strategy guy, responded that the lawsuit is nonsense, that she should have known better than getting on a phone conference while literally in labor, and that they, quote, will not submit to opportunistic lawyers looking to manufacture a payday from us, end quote. All of this is complicated by the fact that the internal Mr. Beast handbook was released a couple of years ago and had some interesting sections like, it's okay for boys to be childish. And one titled, no does not mean no. Though to be clear, that wasn't about sexual assault. No. It was just about pressuring vendors and the such. No does not mean no. Just depends on where you are. You can understand the confusion on the phrasing there as, you know, boys will be boys and it's okay for boys to be childish. Alyssa, I want to hit on one thing with this complaint. Like, I think we all agree that sexual harassment is bad, and who knows what will come of this lawsuit. I want to hit on one specific thing with this complaint, though, which is this fear that the woman who filed it had of just never being able to take time off, right? If there's one thing that kind of defines the modern work environment, it's this idea that we're always on, that hours are fungible. Like, you don't have to work a 9-to-5. You just have to always be available when you're needed. And I think this goes a long way towards explaining why, like, for instance, poll after poll shows that people are unhappier than ever before, despite being in many ways materially better off. Wither the work-life balance, Alyssa?
Wither the work-life balance. I think that there are... I don't know where the work-life balance has gone to, right? I mean, maybe to France, where you can retire at like 32 and, you know, the idea of like a 40-hour work week is criminal.
They have a budget situation that's completely unsustainable because the pensioners make more than people who are actually working.
I don't disagree with you. But yes, I think that flexibility has become sort of a false god for the workplace, right? The idea that you don't really need to work a 40-hour week. And this thing that was presented as really good for employees is, in fact, like, actually has some real problems if you can't actually log off, if your workday can sort of proliferate. And I think this is, you know, it's especially challenging. I think it is especially challenging for women in some ways. If you are the default parent who is expected to pick up kids from school when they get sick, or be the one who chaperones things. There's no world in which people feel like they're not asked to make up for flexibility somewhere, right? Like, it always has to be, there's a balance that always has to be paid back, but the size of the balance is never clear to either the employer or the employee. And so it just becomes this kind of metastasis of the workday. And I think that it is very hard when you are, a subordinate at a company to try and sort of draw those lines in a clear way, and to sort of do it affirmatively. And this is something I think about a lot with remote work too, in the sense that I think that it was supposed to be great for employees. I think there are ways in which it is still great, but it creates this fuzziness around sort of accountability and obligations that I think creates a lot of unnecessary anxiety. Unnecessary, not in the sense that like people shouldn't be worried about what their bosses think of them or what their bosses think they're doing. But I think you lose a sort of a clear sense of, what are the actual expectations here? What are the actual limits? What's reasonable? What's unreasonable? And I suspect that a lot of these sort of new media companies that don't have sort of strong workplace cultures in any case are going to have uniquely difficult times defining what the boundaries should be. And I think that's especially true in new media companies where people's lives are effectively the product, right? I mean, like if you are the million children of Ballerina Farm or lifestyle streamers or whatever, then if there is no actual separation between your life and your product, how are you going to run a company with sort of the understanding that your employees are functioning in a very different way?
Yeah, Peter, I do think that this is kind of the other side of this, right? Which is that, the whole YouTube phenomenon is such a weird and new thing. And there's an element of like the sort of Facebook, like move fast and break things. I think that was Facebook, whatever. Like this, the tech idea of like move fast and break things. And we're a young company. We're trying to figure out what works. All that matters is what works. All that matters is what works. So let's do things that work and make them available, which I think, like, on the one hand is good, and I'm pro flexibility, and I think more companies should frankly be experimenting with things and doing all sorts of new stuff. And I will say, like, at the Bulwark we see a lot of that, like just trying new things, and what works works and what doesn't work doesn't work.
You also have to have a process where you just like you set the metric for what it is that works, right? And and then you make that culturally really clear. Like, it's much harder. Yeah. If you're just like, we'll do what works,
Right. But I think that, I think to this point though, I think that the environment of YouTube makes that very tricky, because what if what works is actually bad? Like, it's a lot of what works on YouTube is bad. Bad. Or maybe not. I don't know, Peter. What do you make of the kind of like the workplace culture versus, culture versus cultural product, all this stuff that's going on here?
Well, I'm just not much of a YouTube watcher, so I don't even know that I can comment on that, except to say that whenever I try to watch YouTube, I'm just sort of like, this is not for me. But that's maybe, I'm not sure that actually has much to do with the question of flexibility here. And actually, maybe not surprisingly, I have a quite different take than Alyssa does. I work at a place that provides pretty extraordinary flexibility for employees to kind of manage their own time. Depends on what kind of job you have and what the expectations are in that job, right? People who have to, say, for example, shoot video in a specific place, you can't do that remotely. That makes it, that's just not possible. But for people who, if you don't need to be in a specific place, in a lot of cases, we have, especially for people who have been there for a long time, an awful lot of flexibility to work from where you want to work, and then also to some degree when you want to work. And this has really radically improved my life. And I think, I think that has been true for many of my colleagues as well. Obviously, I can't speak for absolutely everyone there, but I can just say that, like, that has been a huge factor in enjoying my work and my workplace is that I can do it that way. And it also means that I then feel like, yes, like sometimes I'm going to have to log on Sunday morning or Tuesday evening, or maybe even every single night of the week if it is the Republican National Convention or the DNC or something like that. And it's not that I'm asked to, it's just I understand that this is my responsibility. And I just don't mind that very much. It is I like working in a culture that has a lot of flexibility and then rewards initiative within that. And I just don't think that you can run a workplace effectively, especially one that has a kind of creative product that is sort of not just kind of made on, we build widgets, right? And then we just need to build X number of widgets per month, right? Where the product is a little bit fuzzy, can change throughout time, right? It requires the product itself requires a kind of flexibility. If you are in the news business, this is also true in the YouTube business, in kind of any creative business. And I think that it's very difficult to run that without some sort of give and take, some sort of, you can't define absolutely everything that everyone is going to do in advance. And anybody who is working in a role that is going to be extremely defined, kind of hyper, you know, bullet pointed, and this is what you have to do, but all you have to do in advance, that leaves, among other things, that leaves no place for an employee to take initiative and to be responsive and sort of to do more, because it's entirely defined. And as somebody who wants to contribute, I like looking for novel and maybe unexpected and unclear ways that I can contribute to what we're doing at the office. And I think, I think sometimes about this story that has been around for probably a decade or so. So Paul Graham is a very famous investor from Y Combinator, which is this a startup accelerator. And he said, I want to say about 10 years ago, it might have been a little more recent than that. He said that one of the strongest indicators of whether or not a founder is going to be a good founder and somebody who's going to be successful or not is if that person responds to the email that he sends immediately. And so one thing that's been kind of funny about this is that like the next generation of founders is all like completely obsessed with responding to email very quickly, at least where their funders are concerned. But this also just tells you that if you are in a business that is changing, that isn't sort of perfectly set, that isn't just sort of like, here's, we do X and that's all we do and we never do anything else. You're in a business that is inherently flexible and creative, then a lot of what needs to be done is people need to, on their own, take initiative and identify what needs to be done without being told to. And that's just how, that's right. I mean, it's almost like this is true to some degree in a family as well, right? Like you don't, I mean, yes, you might negotiate that one person is the primary dishes doer and the other person is the primary cook or something like that. At the same time, a big part of being a family unit is just, oh, this person, that person had to be out this evening. I'm going to have to take over this sort of thing, right? It's just sort of finding things to do to be helpful that aren't necessarily all totally spelled out and scheduled and shifted. And in exchange, you have a good, like, if this works well, I can see it working badly, for sure. But if this works well, what that means is that everybody feels like everybody else is looking for ways to make things better for the family or for the organization and to help everyone else out when they can. And it actually builds trust within an organization because everybody understands that everybody is there in it together, working towards the same thing and trying to do the best they can.
So with I was not my most articulate at the beginning of this podcast session. It's been a long weekend. But I think there's actually a synthesis between what the two of us are saying, which is your office's policy of extreme flexibility and creating space for innovation works in part because there is a strong pre-existing workplace culture and a strong sort of management team, right? And so, you know, you're not going to end up in a situation where people are doing that out of fear. They're doing it, you know, they are, if they're working extra hours, they're doing it out of creativity. And places with weak workplace cultures, with nascent workplace cultures, don't necessarily need a lot of rules, but they need a lot of communication and they need a strongly articulated set of values. And if you are in, you know, I think that flexible and remote situations can be open to abuse, in places that don't have those principles and values sort of clearly articulated and that have weak management. And, you know, I think that is
I agree with that to some degree. Like I said, I think there's a you know, downside cases. There's scenarios in which it might not work well. But I also think that just especially in a creative field, like it's a much better work environment where there's a lot of flexibility and not necessarily sort of hyper clarity about you do this and only do this and only at these times, but also the alternative, like shift work, right? Sort of like really kind of hard, like clearly, like strongly defined, you know, sort of you clock in and then you clock out and you're done. I understand there's some people who actually prefer that, and there's, you know, advantages both for employees and employers in some ways. But I also think that for a lot of employees, that like working that way is not great, especially right if you're just like, because part of what that means is then when you have to pick up kids or take a dog to the doctor or whatever it is, when you need those moments of flexibility, they're just absolutely not there. And there are going to be trade-offs for getting that flexibility for sure, but I would much rather have it.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is, a lot of this boils down to don't be an asshole. And that goes both directions, in both for management and for employees. And the problem in the I like, if you do not have a place that is set up to, you know, kind of inculcate a culture of like not being an asshole, not leaving people in the lurch, but also not expecting people to be on call 24 hours a day, you're going to run into trouble. And that's what it sounded like here. I'm sorry if this lady was taking conference calls while she was in labor. That suggests to me a culture that is bad and broken. Even if, you know, she was, even if they showed her the handbook that was like, you're not supposed to take conference calls while you're in labor. Like, okay, she felt the need to do it. So that's probably not great.
I will say, contradicting everything I have said previously and sharing one of my favorite pieces of movie trivia, Stephanie Beatriz, when she laid down the track for Waiting on a Miracle, which is the I Want song in Moana, laid down the track, the version of that track that made it into the movie while she was in labor.
Well, good for her. Still. Anyway.
And
all right.
This is maybe a different, just really quickly, this is maybe like a different way of thinking about this, which is everybody's individual and workplace organizational circumstances are going to be different. We shouldn't sort of go in saying there needs to be some sort of standard. Like, you have to work these things out. Sometimes they will work out, I think, unpleasantly, but ideally you want to leave maximum flexibility for these things to be worked out at the individual and organization level.
Okay. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that Mr. Beast just loves to work hard and expects the same from his lazy, ungrateful employees? Peter.
And I don't know about this lawsuit. This is what courts are for. Don't ask me.
Alyssa.
Mr. Beast is controversial.
It's an absolute controversy. Sounds like a terrible place to work, but I'm sure they're very successful, so what do I know? Make sure to swing by movieisle.substack.com on Thursday for a special bonus episode on why culture writers always want to talk about politics and maybe why they shouldn't, and also vice versa, by the way. I got some thoughts about politics writers getting in on the cultural game. We'll discuss well. In a very locked down private episode that will not be heard by any of our friends who don't subscribe to this thing, because I don't want to get yelled at. Now
to be clear,
on to
I'm right
the
here.
Main event, Michael, the new Michael Jackson biopic, which covers his life from his early days with the Jackson 5 up until the release of Bad in 1987. Nothing happened after that. Is an enormous hit with audiences, grossing nearly $100 million this weekend domestically, earning an A- from CinemaScore, which polls opening night audiences. Critics are less enamored with the film, which has just a 38% fresh rating as of this taping. In my own review, I noted that it was dramatically inert, but it had nice songs. And most people who go to a movie like this just want nice songs. We'll discuss both in a second, both the dramatic inertness and the nice songs. But first, we have to understand why this movie is what it is. And that's because, as Matt Bellany has been reporting over the last few years, the film had to undergo massive reshoots when someone in the Jackson estate, which is involved with the making of this film, one of whom is a producer on the film and also appears in the film, he's played by Miles Teller in a very hilarious bit of vanity casting, realized after the film had been like shot and edited that they weren't legally allowed to dramatically depict the sexual abuse allegations leveled by 13-year-old Jordan Chandler in the early 1990s. How did the film play out? Let's go to Bellany here, who has actually read the shooting script. Quote, the script begins and ends during the 1993 investigation into statements about Jackson's anatomy made by Jordan Chandler, the then 13-year-old boy whose molestation claim led to worldwide headlines and an eventual $20 million settlement. The script depicts Jackson as the naive victim of the money-grubbing Chandlers, whose unfounded claims force Jackson to endure ridicule and persecution until he ultimately settles, his resolve and reputation forever in tatters. End quote. Whoopsie-daisy. Anyway, to stay clear of any legal injunctions or further lawsuits, this was all scrapped. And director Antoine Fuqua had to come back and shoot a whole bunch of new stuff. Apparently, $50 million worth of reshoots went into this.
At least some reports did suggest that Fuqua, this is rumor, but Fuqua didn't actually perform the reshoots himself.
Well, I have seen that from less reputable sites. I'll put it that way.
I said it's rumor.
It's a rumor, and it's certainly not what was suggested in his big piece with the New Yorker. He did not say he was not on set. They just did reshoots. Anyway, the reshoots mostly seem to involve Jackson's father, Joseph, who's played by Coleman Domingo in this film. He was notoriously a real son of a bitch and is so portrayed here as well, with almost campy evil by a hunched, sneering Domingo. You can see where some of the reshoots likely came in. For instance, in a sequence that for some reason involves Don King. That is pure reshoot, by the way. That whole sequence where Don King's like, what are you going to give me to promote your boys? And it's just like, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. Anyway, the problem with this film is that it has no real tension. MJ is portrayed throughout as almost literally a saint. He's just this angelic, voiced, soulful dancer who spends most of his time talking to animals because he can't relate to people. And he's visiting sick kids in the hospitals. He's definitely never doing anything else with children. Don't even think about mentioning that at all. Everyone loves him, except for Joseph. Everyone wants him to succeed. I mean, Joseph also wants him to succeed so he can leech off of him. And then the fans adore him. And the record execs are sticking their neck out for him. And producers are like, here, Michael, let me show you how to mix an album. You're so cool. You ask so many good questions. I love you, Michael Jackson. You're the best. This is not a dramatically satisfying film. However, Jafar Jackson plays his uncle Michael with real skill. Say what you will about this movie, but it has good songs, and people enjoy hearing good songs in movie theaters. They like to sing along to the songs in the movie theater. Sometimes they'll get up and do some dancing. I've seen videos of people dancing. People were dancing at the screening I was at, the preview screening. Okay. It's whatever. It is what it is. And I am in a weird, I'm in like kind of a weird critical position here where I hold multiple thoughts in my head simultaneously about this film. The version of the film that we have here, it succeeds at what it sets out to do, which is to give fans of MJ songs to listen to, right? But this version of the film is also completely, as I said, dramatically inert and thus fails as storytelling. The version of the film that first existed seems like it is actually evil, but would oddly have been a much more dramatically interesting and probably therefore better film by leaning into the evil. I don't know. Peter, when we were deciding to review this movie this week, you were like real annoyed. You were real annoyed. You did not want to do it. But I assume that the spirit of the music won you over and you were just dancing in the aisles listening to all the songs, right?
I was not dancing in the aisles listening to all the songs because I can do that anytime I want at home on amazing speakers. And this is the movie's real failure. The deep failure here is, okay, sure, it's going to be a completely angelic portrayal of Michael Jackson that has absolutely no insight into him whatsoever. Not just has no insight, but like recoils from the idea of insight. I felt stupider about Michael Jackson leaving this movie. Like somehow or another, it had sucked knowledge out of my head. This is a stunning feat of anti-insight. All right, fine. It's hagiographic, whatever the word is, right? Like, it's just going to treat him like a saint. That's baked into this because his estate is sponsoring this. This is not a movie that delivers the music well. And this is a big problem because Michael Jackson's music, certainly the era portrayed in this movie from the 70s, but particularly from about 1980 through about 1987, Michael Jackson's music is revolutionary. And this movie doesn't care at all about how that music was made or even how it's supposed to sound. And this is like, this movie was an opportunity to let normies who have never heard Thriller on a great set of speakers experience the absolutely incredible, lush, vivid cinematic production, Quincy Jones on that record. That record is just like absolutely astounding. I didn't get it until I was about 30 years old and got my first good pair of speakers and a copy of the album from the 1980s, or I listened on vinyl. You know, I was a kid when these things were coming out, and I sort of thought Michael Jackson was cheesy. And then I went back and listened to them as an adult, and I was like, oh my goodness, Quincy Jones is a genius. These songs are genius. This is what pop is supposed to be. And it's not just that they are structured impeccably, it's that they are layered so deeply with so many different interesting sounds and rhythms. These are just songs like for the ages in a way that I can't, like, you can only experience it by hearing it on a great set of speakers. And what this movie does is it chops those songs up. We get different mastering and different mixes because they've mixed it for surround sound, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but these things are two-channel masterpieces. And then throughout those songs, you get a bunch of dialogue. The dialogue steps on some of the best parts and doesn't let them like just sort of play out and doesn't let you just listen to them. In addition to that, yes, there's a couple of scenes with Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson sitting at the board, but there's literally no scenes of them discussing their musical approach and how it is that they built, wrote, structured, like designed these songs. Nothing, right? There's nothing about the music in this. It's not just that there's nothing about Michael Jackson in this movie about Michael Jackson. There's also nothing about the music in this movie about Michael Jackson's music. Yeah. And yeah,
we had a movie like this released not very long ago. It was called Deliver Me From Nowhere. It was the Bruce Springsteen movie, and nobody went to go see it. You know why? Because nobody actually cares how records are mixed. That's nobody actually cares about that. They just want to hear
the music. I didn't see
that one,
but that's because we didn't have to review it. And I don't give a crap about Bruce Springsteen.
Well, you would have really enjoyed that one, I think. It was all about the mixing. It was all about, you would have learned so much about the wall of sound and whatever.
That sounds like a better movie. This is, in fact, as we walked out, I said to Alyssa that the movie I wanted to see was 2.5 hours of Quincy Jones sitting at the board going, a little more, a little more trumpet. No, just pull it back. No, just, yeah. That's all I wanted to see.
That movie's not going to gross $1 billion, but this one is. Alyssa, what do you make of Michael?
Like Peter, I was very frustrated by it. And part of the reason I was frustrated by it is I have actually read MJ, The Genius of Michael Jackson by Steve Knopper. And if you are interested in how Michael Jackson's music is made, which, believe it or not, is a process that's even more interesting than the one that Peter is describing here, not least because Jackson never really learned to write musical notation, but was incredibly good at sort of hearing things in his head and then translating them via detailed notes. He was using all sorts of really interesting novel technology, but also there are sequences in some of his most important albums where you'll see credits for a wooden deck that was built in a room in the studio that people were jumping on, or like stuff that he was like drumming on in the bathroom. Like, it is a really interesting, almost synesthetic view of music making and choreography that's really interesting. But it is also just in its single-minded determination to make Joe Jackson a villain, but specifically, interestingly, not always a villain in the ways that involved him like repeatedly and rampantly like cheating on Catherine and having at least one kid with other women. It doesn't capture any of Jackson's relationships with collaborators who he, sort of took on and then sloughed off. And one of the very interesting sort of theses in Knopper's book about Jackson is that there is an extent to which Jackson was freeing himself of sort of musical and choreographers who were his collaborators. He was sort of stripping away management and creative collaborators. At the same time, he was stripping away anyone who would say no to him in his personal life. And the argument of this book is sort of that Jackson's kind of decline as a musical artist and his just, you know, moral downfall as a human being were kind of intertwined with each other. And that is a really interesting story, right? But it's one that that forces you to acknowledge that, you know, subsequent albums were not as good as Thriller. That there are ways in which his music acted as sort of cover for his interest in children. It is a story in which Jackson has much more agency. And I think one of the things that is weird about this movie is that it, by refusing to give Jackson agency in any way that would allow people to risk seeing him as a villain, it also just takes away anything that allows us to understand him as a genius, right? I mean, if he is a person who is just, you know, the music is just sort of, you know, channeled through him and, you know, he is entirely like a pure, sweet weirdo walking his llama down the streets of Encino, California, he can't do any evil, but he can't be responsible for, you know, innovation. He can't be a guiding force in either his music and choreography or his own life. The closest he gets to sort of a villainous moment in the movie is at the end of the Victory Tour, when his way of sort of freeing himself from having a tour with his brothers is not to like have a mature adult conversation about the fact that like, I'm a solo artist, I'm sorry, I cannot sing ABC on stage one more time. It's to announce on stage, it's like, this is our final performance. And to sort of upstage his brothers. One thing I will say about the movie.
Did you see that as a villain moment? Because
I
saw that as
I don't think that's a villainous moment at all.
The moment in which he defeats his father. It's the first time he actually takes initiative on his own, because all of the other times he has to confront his father, at the very beginning of the movie, you know, I should say the very beginning of the second act, when we first see him as an adult, basically the first thing he does is he says, oh, sure, I'll talk to my dad. And then he's like, but I need you to fire him. I need you to, right? Like, he's constantly using intermediaries because he's too afraid to do it himself. And so this was the movie's argument, to the extent it is making one here, is that he was only able to do so through the triumph of his performance.
And I'll say, and the other thing here, though, is that very specifically in the film, he makes this announcement, which like kind of screws his brothers. I mean, depending on how we want to look at it, it does kind of screw them. And they all look at him with like big smiles and like, yeah, this is right.
Yes.
This is like, it's like they're all totally fine with it.
I did not interpret it that way at all. Like, I thought there was like a lot of, like, if you see them on stage, there's like much more. I mean, they clearly have been blindsided. But in any case, yeah, there is just like, there's such a lack of interest in Michael Jackson. One thing that is fascinating about the movie, and part of the reason I went back and reread, I'm not done with the book, but I started rereading the book, is because I wanted to see, I wanted to fact check some of the movie, because there's some scenes that feel incredibly weird and off, right? Like there, where one in which he like recruits the Crips and the Bloods to be in the video for Beat It, or when he has a CBS executive played by Mike Myers, of all people, threaten him to like pull all of his artists from MTV. Interestingly enough, both of those things are true. They really happened. And part of what is fascinating about Michael Jackson's life is that he was someone who could get like the Crips and the Bloods together, at least for the duration of a video, and turn them all into sort of gushing fanboys, right? Like, he really did revolutionize the music industry, like desegregate it in certain ways, like help bring new Jack Swing into the mainstream, you know, make MTV what it was. Like, the story of Michael Jackson is in some ways the story of the American century. And it diminishes him so much it diminishes him as well as, you know, sanitizing him by making him this sort of holy fool. It is tragic as well as a not very good movie, right? It's not a good story. It's not a true story. It's not even a particularly well-told story, but God, the music and just the, like, I know for Peter, for you, it's like the music on Thriller, but the dancing for me, right? Like, we have just dance as an art is sort of so marginal in American society. And I just think about what the impact of Michael Jackson would have been like.
Timothy Chalamet was said.
What Michael Jackson's impact would have been like in the age of, like, there's this sort of TikTok dance resurgence, right? Can you imagine a country where, like, everyone is figuring out how to moonwalk, you know, where everyone is, like, interested in the, you know, is... He was such... The things he could do with his body were so remarkable. And there's no curiosity about the choreography either, about, like, the fact that, you know, the amount of his work that is, like, sort of borrowed from Soul Train and Marcel Marceau. And, you know, it just... This is the story of American culture, and the movie isn't interested in it. And that makes Michael Jackson look small.
Yeah, it really is. It's a frustrating movie in a lot of ways, because he is, if not the great pop star of the last 50 years, then certainly one the top two or three. Like, he was a singular force in the world of music. He was popular in a way that even this film, like, doesn't quite get at. Like, yeah, he sold out stadium tours, and yeah, people were outside of his hotel. But you see this with, like, you could make this same basic movie about, you know, virtually. Anyway, they probably did similar. They had similar stuff in the Amy Winehouse biopic that came out, you know, a couple years back, and she was nowhere near this big. The real frustration here is that it is a movie that in its, and again, this is because it is made with the accommodations of the estate, because his lawyer, John Branca, again, who's played by Miles Teller in the movie, is one of the producers of the film, doesn't want to do anything that would make him a complicated figure at all. And, like, I just, like, what's the point? Now, I'll tell you what the point is. Point is, as I said, $1 billion, because that's about what this movie's going to end up making. It's going to make a ridiculous, insane amount of money. And it, just like the Queen movie that came out, Bohemian Rhapsody.
Same producer.
From the same producer, Graham King. That movie made a ton of money with the, you know, with the folks from Queen who were still alive, Brian May and all those guys. And also kind of elided over some of the, you know, some of the aspects of Freddie Mercury's life that they didn't want to get into. This movie is going to be hugely successful. It is going to be defended by fans. And I'm really curious to see if they make a sequel, because this movie ends with a title card that says his story continues. And, like, I don't know if you guys know this, but they used all the good songs. There's not a lot after 1987 for them to rely on for a sequel. So that's just going to be all about child abuse and maybe the Nation of Islam. Like, what are they going to do?
The report is that as of this morning, the sequel has been greenlit, and that it is going to cover the period of mostly of the 1990s, basically through the very early aughts, and that it is once again going to focus sort of on an album by album kind of presentation of the music. I mean, I think they are coming very close at this point to basically saying, we are not telling the Michael Jackson story. What we are doing is playing the songs in a row, and then there's some Wikipedia, like, if you know, it's not text, but it's like Wikipedia like scenes that don't interpret anything, just sort of reference events that happened underneath the music. And obviously his most popular and most enduring stuff came from the 1980s, but I do think his fans, many of them, still like a lot of the music that came out after Bad and into the 90s.
I mean, the only way this works is if it's an alternate history, because, you know, Janet Jackson is not a character in this movie, I think.
Yeah, like, she asked not to be included, so.
And so maybe this is just an alternate universe Michael Jackson, where, like, Janet wasn't born and didn't actually molest anybody, and it's all fine.
It's Earth 2, only... MJ. This is actually we're now in the universe that The Flash wound up in The Flash movie, where George Clooney is still Batman.
You're torturing me. I'm now just thinking which movie I'd least rather watch again. I don't know.
Okay. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Michael? Alyssa?
Thumbs down. Listen to the music instead, preferably on Peter's speaker system.
Peter?
I hated this movie with the passion of a thousand Quincy Jones, like cool little clap sounds. And what it just seriously, listen to the music. The music is incredible, Thriller in particular, but all of the albums from the 1980s are just like, find a good set of speakers or a great set of over-ear headphones. If you've never done it, just sat and listened to the music, it will blow you away.
If you just want to hear good Michael Jackson songs, a thumbs up. If you want like an actual movie, thumbs down. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch and our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday. Hopefully.